My name is John Geer, and I'm professor of political science here, and my trusty colleague, Professor Roy Neal, who actually dabbles, and more than dabbles, in real-world politics. We're here to talk to you, as you know, about the 2008 presidential election, giving you our guesses and estimations about what may or may not happen during the course of the 08 campaign, which, of course, is already in full swing, as you full well know. Let me just start by saying that it's great fun for Roy and I to be able to do this, partly because we love elections and we love politics, but also because this is just a great time for all of you because of your children and your grandchildren and others getting to graduate here at Vanderbilt, and it's just our way of having a greater chance to interact with all of you because this is just such a fun time for the university and for all of you as well. So I guess what we'll do is we'll start. I want to set a little bit of the context, some of this that you're aware of, others may not be aware, and then we will get into some predictions. And of course, we'll leave plenty of time for questions because I'm sure, in fact, people have lots of questions about what's unfolding. First of all, a couple of things about the 08 race that I think needs to be taken into account. First, this is the most open presidential race in recent memory. That is, it's been since 1952 that you haven't had a president or a vice president running for the presidency. That is, as re-election or seeking their own term as a vice president seeking to become president. So as a result, we have no incumbent. And that means that both sides are very open, both sides are very fluid, and it's difficult to predict nominations even when you have a front runner. But in this particular year, it's even more difficult because there's really no clear front runners. We will have various guesses about it, but there's lots of good candidates on both sides. So that's part one. Part two, that the structure of the election for 08 actually favors the Democrats. Now, I'll say why that's the case. And for those of you who are Republicans, take a big breath and just relax, okay? And don't worry about that.
Liberal university professor.
Yeah. I wanted to wear a pink shirt, but I didn't. But in any case, actually, compared to my colleagues, I'm quite conservative, which should get all of your parents worried and ask for a refund from Gordon Gee. In any case, the things that favor the Democrats are as follows. First of all, it's very hard for any party to win three presidential elections in a row. It doesn't happen very often. So the public gets tired of a party in power, and they tend to want to replace that party. And so on average, that's one thing that helps the Democrats, because obviously President Bush won in 2000, but my colleague might want to quibble with that, and 2004. So that's one thing. The second thing, that the public largely rewards peace, prosperity, and moderation. Okay, that when, in fact, the country's at war, when our economy is struggling, or when we're not pursuing very moderate policies, the public tends to get upset. And those things are really not working to the Republicans' advantage either. Okay. Interestingly, though, the economy actually is doing pretty well. But President Bush almost gets no credit for it because, of course, the overarching issue of Iraq and terrorism, et cetera, and all the problems coming out of Iraq. So those things favor. The final thing that's unfolding right now that's very interesting, that's getting, in fact, moderate Republicans, for example, very upset, is there seems to be a shifting in people's partisanship for the first time in a long time towards the Democratic Party. That there's so much unhappiness with Iraq that Republican loyalties, which have been a small majority, is ebbing slightly towards the Democrats. And so that's another structural problem that faces the Republican Party. So you take all these into account, there's a slight edge for the Democrats. But I say slight because it depends on who the candidates are. It depends on the kinds of issues. It could depend on, God forbid, another terrorist attack. There's lots of things that could unfold. It may be the situation in Iraq. Everybody hopes this is the case, turns around, and things start working better. And if that's the case, that could obviously change things. But right now, structurally, you have to give a little edge to the Democrats. But that's just a small edge. And so though that's kind of what political science has to say about it. Now I'm going to let my colleague here talk a little bit about some of the issues, and then we're going to get to candidates.
Every presidential campaign ultimately surrounds issues, and as you know from past campaigns, particularly the 92 campaign, where Bill Clinton's slogan was, is the economy stupid? It's always near the top of any agenda. The immigration issue, which is hot now and divides, maybe divides Republicans more than Democrats. The social issues, abortion, gay marriage, name some others. Who's got some other issues they think will drive this election?
Environment.
Maybe even global warming.
I knew he'd get that word in. The vice president told me how to say this.
He doesn't know I'm here. Any other issues?
War.
What?
War.
We'll come to that.
Education.
What's that?
Education.
Education, maybe.
Social Security.
Medicare.
Yeah.
Deficits.
Real. I would beg to differ on that. Dick Cheney said it doesn't matter. So I'll accept that.
It's the only time he's ever taken Dick Cheney's word on anything.
Not to diminish that. The Democrats are trying to make it an issue. Democrats have a hard time on making the deficit an issue. They would love to be able to, but it doesn't really work for them all that much. So yeah, well, this is a list of issues that they're typically there all the time. But as somebody pointed out, there are really only two issues that are driving this campaign right now, because all the candidates, except some of the squabbling within the party, particularly among the Republicans on an issue like immigration, for instance, or now particularly on issues of choice, stem cell research, and so on, and gay marriage. We have a big unexpected divide among the Republican candidates, but there are really two issues in my view. And yes, one is Iraq. When are we going to get out of it all? And the other issue, and John alluded to this, is the president himself and all of the issues that give the Democrats ammunition and are making the Republicans very uncomfortable. Not just Iraq. It's the competence of the administration on things like handling the Katrina thing. It's the attorney general decisions to fire the U.S. attorneys. And, you know, for some of you, those are not issues. But it's the whole issue of President Bush's favorability. And his confidence, if you will, and that's driving a lot of this. In one of the polls this week, had the president's favorability rating now down below 30%. So it's getting close to Nixon-esque. Now, you know, to his credit, sometimes that represents leadership, as it did with Truman, as it has with other presidents, Churchill in the UK. So he probably doesn't care a lot about this right now. So, but anyway, Bush is a huge issue. It's a huge issue, this whole, his leadership, that of his administration, and so on. And of course, the Iraq War is the one that's being counted every day. So this is sort of a template for what the candidates are talking about. Because as John said, there's no clear prohibitive favorite. No sitting vice president, no incumbent president, of course. No sitting vice president running for election. So they have to find ways to differentiate themselves. And because there's no prohibitive front runner, and that I think even applies to Senator Clinton, we'll talk a little bit about this, no one has the reins on this race.
And so one of the things that we should stress is that our ability to predict the winner of the general election, right now you have to say the Democratic nominee is a likely victor. But the actual individuals who become the nominees, that's very tricky to predict, because somebody could make a mistake, somebody could end up catching on fire, maybe in a way that they're going down, or they're doing really well. It's a very fluid kind of system. So we looked at polls, but I would not pay much attention to polls. Giuliani's the favorite. I'd be stunned if he wins the Republican nomination. But again, I actually held out hope for Walter Mondale in 1984, so I'm not sure that you want to put a lot of faith in my general judgments. But in any case, we actually had a PowerPoint, but somehow it was saved in the wrong format, so we had it all listed out, trying to give you a sense of what we think are the likely contenders, and then who actually will be be the president, it's kind of the best guess that we had at the time.
It was a really good PowerPoint.
It really was. He didn't do it. He said to me this morning, we talked about this at various points in time.
If I'd just done it in Keynote instead, it would have been,
yeah.
Yes.
So,
you Apple folks would get that.
So in any case, let's go ahead.
Let me make an observation first. One of the things we've already seen, when you have a field that is so undefined and where there is no prohibitive favor, is that little mistakes that wouldn't make much difference later in a campaign once you've established yourself, or for, say, an incumbent president, but little verbal slip-ups can be a huge problem for a candidate who's trying to get attention in a positive light. Just witness Joe Biden's comments a few months ago, and when he was referring to Senator Obama. That virtually killed his campaign before he could really get it started. He will not recover. He probably would not have taken off anyway, but this was a killer. And little things like that, Senator McCain the other day, he was trying to be funny and parodying a Beach Boys song about bombing Iran. I don't know how many of you heard that. Well, it was funny in a different context. It might have worked, but this is potentially the next president who's got the football being carried around with him all the time and has the keys to a nuclear arsenal. So it didn't quite work. And these kinds of slip-ups can be terribly damaging at this point in the campaign.
How about Edward's $600 haircut?
Well, he didn't talk about it. It was sort of turned out. It was $400.
$400 for a haircut. I only spent $250. People laugh at me. That's not an affair. Very mean. $400 from a campaign and a candidate who's claiming to be for the poor.
But also the reason this has been a problem for Senator Edwards is because part of his vulnerability is his perception as being sort of a lightweight and a pretty boy. The Republicans denigrate him as the Brett boy, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's not fair. I mean, I can think of a lot of other characterizations of some of their candidates, but the fact is that it sticks when there is a perception. And this is a problem. McCain considered to have a temper and short views and all, so that kind of comment might stick. I can't make an excuse for Biden.
But it is definitely true that small little issues will play much bigger. And sometimes to your benefit. I mean, right now I think Romney's having a pretty good news cycle because he was able to take on Al Sharpton. Anytime you do that, it's probably a twofer. And Sharpton made some comments that suggested the Mormons don't believe in God, and that's certainly a troubling statement. And there was response by Romney. He gets a little bit of an edge because he's able to go after Sharpton, which is, will play well among conservatives, but also then trying to educate people about the Mormon religion. So that's a benefit. So that's one reason why it's so hard to figure out who's the likely nominee, because some sort of trip up could occur and people can just go down very quickly, or they can rise. And that's one of the things you'll see. In the general election, you see stability and people's preferences, movements here or there, because you're talking about Democrats and Republicans, and you have the anchor of partisanship. I mean, remember that all of you, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you're pretty committed to that party. I mean, I always tell my students, and they kind of get a little worried about this, that as a Republican or a Democrat, that was socialized by your parents for 18 years, and you think like your parents and get ready to start looking like them as well. Which troubles them, but those are the facts. It troubles me, given my father, but I love him.
The folks out before you, there are a few seats, and also there are the steps if you want to join us in here, or maybe you just want to be able to get out.
Yeah, they're looking for the quick exit. So you want to do the odds here?
Yeah.
Let's do the Republicans.
You go first.
Okay. So, in my sense of the Republican nomination, I'm not a big Giuliani fan. I'll use black.
Yeah.
I was going to use blue for the blue and red, but I put him at 8-1. I don't think he's likely to get it. I put McCain at 5-1. Romney at 5-1. Partly because I think that Romney is a real policy wonk and he could come on. Brownback, I'm not a big fan of, 30-1. Gingrich. You have to put down Gingrich. He wants to run so bad. I mean, he came and gave a talk here at Vanderbilt as part of the Impact Symposium. And I had a chance to interact with him very briefly, but the man wants it badly. But sorry, Newt, 50-1. Huckabee, I think, is somebody who's probably got a decent chance, but I'm still going to put him at 20-1. Tommy Thompson, I saw him on the Bill Maher show last night. I want to put him at about 30,000-1, but I'll make it 1,000-1. Ron Paul, I didn't even know he was running until the debate took place, so you know, I'm putting him at 10,000-1. I'm saving Fred Thompson because I'm actually putting him at 4-1.
Duncan Hunter,
500-1. Actually, I mean, these candidates like myself, well, Hunter in particular, and then there's a few others, I suppose, more single-issue kinds of candidates. But nonetheless, I mean, this is a serious contender, but just not likely to be somebody who's going to win the nomination. It strikes me that Thompson's got a huge chance if he gets his, if he really wants it badly enough. And that's the big question, and I don't have an answer to that. But because of the problems of these other three front-runners, I think Thompson has a legitimate shot. Some people have said, well, Fred Thompson was, you know, divorced, and he was single for a while, and he's admitted to having chased women, and if they chased him, they caught him, or whatever. And people say that's going to be a problem, but he's got a huge advantage in this race, because by comparison to Giuliani, he is a Boy Scout. I don't worry about the Thompson effect at that point in time. But in any case, I actually did a news media interview where my wife was listening, and it was on the radio, and I was doing, and I said, you know, almost freaking Boy Scout. And I backed off, and she could tell that I caught myself because I really didn't want to say that on the radio. So those are my lineups, and now I will let my colleague here disagree with me.
You are so irreverent. Just, well, first of all, you can sort of take this group and block them off. None of them are going to be the nominee. So you could assign a million to one if necessary. But just for sport, I would put Gingrich at 100-1.
That's wrong.
I would make Brownback probably 200-1. He's too exclusive. His Republican ten is a very small one. Tommy Thompson, I have more respect for Tommy Thompson than John does. I think he's a very solid guy, so I'll put him at 500-1. Duncan Hunter is a very serious guy, a conservative Southern California, a real hawk. So I would sort of accept John's point of this. Huckabee, I don't buy it. Famous guy for losing 100 pounds. He gets a lot of credit for that. He's a really good governor of Arkansas. But I'd say he's probably off the chart at about 1,000-1. And Ron Paul, you know, it's at least that. But then you go to the first tier of candidates. We're not all that far apart. I still make McCain at 3-1. And I make Giuliani actually at 3-1 also. I think Giuliani can't be the nominee. Romney, I don't really quite buy it. I think he's the John Edwards of the Republican Party, and I'll put him at 5-1. And Thompson, I sort of agree with John. I think he's got a real opportunity, but he is in the seduction phase. He's hearing the sirens saying, come on, get in the race, you're terrific. And he's got all these people saying wonderful things about him. And he's a very solid guy, and don't believe that stuff about him being lazy. But the point is, he has no idea what's about to hit him. With the minute he declares, he'll get great press the next day, but the very next day, the hammer comes down, and then he's just like the rest of them. And it's unclear how he'll be able to deal with it.
Okay, so those are our odds. Now let's go. Yeah. You can do the Democrats first.
You want me to go first?
Sure.
Then you get to.
Then I get to make fun of you. I think that's only fair.
Okay. I think that for all the concerns among Democrats about Senator Clinton and all of the statements that she can't win a general election, she is rock solid with about 40% of the Democratic Party right now. And so I would put Senator Clinton at 3-1. Senator Obama, probably the freshest most interesting presidential candidate we've had in quite a while, but he's learning. He's sort of in training at this point, but he's not doing all that badly, despite the fact that he noted there were 10,000 people who died in the Kansas tornado. It's a small thing, but he's going to learn. He's going to learn, and I think he's got great promise. Senator Edwards is probably about 8-1, in my estimation. Senator Biden, you began, and here again, you've got the same situation. This is our first tier of Democrats and our something else. I left off Bill Richardson. Sorry about that. Who really, by the way, is I'm going to make at 10-1 with a bullet. I think Bill Richardson has real promise to vault into this territory. Senator Biden, he's a wonderful senator, one of the smartest guys on foreign policy, but I don't think so. Senator Dodd, basically the same sort of thing. And I would put him also at 100-1. Mike Gravel probably did the best job in the debate the other night, according to a lot of people that saw it, but it's not going to happen. Dennis Kucinich, I don't know. Who knows? I wouldn't even venture a guess. So anyway, that's my take on it.
Oh, come on. That's why you guys were all here, because it's possible coming out of Gore.
If Al Gore's not running, he's not running, he still shows up in polls. So just for the purpose of the exercise, my sense is that if he were to run, I think he would be 3-1. I mean, immediately, overnight, coming into the race.
Okay, so now, this is actually pretty sad, but here, I agree with about putting it 3-1. I have Obama at slightly better odds. I think that he is learning, but he's going to get some slack cut, and he has the ability to reach out. Where Clinton has a 40% rock-solid Democratic vote, and so she has a basement, or a floor, if you will, she also has a ceiling. And that is a certain amount of support that she's just never going to get. Where Obama's support is really quite unlimited. He could sweep if, in fact, things went right. I'll just start out with Gore. I think that if he chooses to run, he would likely get the nomination and put in a 2-1. Edwards, I just don't buy the haircut stuff. I'm very upset about that. So I put it 9-1. These are all...
Just because he has hair, you're well.
Okay, that's the true story.
We really are the click and clack.
Make fun of my hair. I don't know. I agree with Richardson. I put him at 15-1 to 10-1, and the chance of going up is quite true. He has some interesting ads that he's now running in Iowa that I think will be interesting to see how they play. He's willing to take some gambles, and so he's formidable. Kucinich, actually, when I wrote on the PowerPoint, was that Roy Neal has a higher chance of winning the presidency than Dennis Kucinich. So, in other words, I'm not willing to put it down because I know that I can't get Roy to run, so as a result, we're just going to put him down. He ran in 2004 with this, I think, the objective of getting married. And he was able to, but he actually had to order the woman online, I think, or something like that. So, he's not, no, he mailed her right. This guy's just... People want to run for the presidency, some of them, because they just kind of enjoy the process. It's not because they think they're going to win. And so there are a set of people. I think these individuals, I'm not sure about Gravel, but these two are doing because they do think they somehow could get up to this thing, but I suspect they're deluding themselves. There's no way. But the bottom line is that these are the likely ones, with Richardson being the possibility. So then the question becomes, and then we'll start taking questions, is... Who are the two nominees, and who's the next president of the United States? And so I will go first.
Want to go ahead and do your prediction?
Yeah. So I'm going to pick, it's going to be Obama versus Fred, with Obama being the president. Okay, now.
You are so wrong.
Wait till you see his prediction. You're going to come around to mine pretty
soon. I have to preface this. I said say these are only my opinions, and they have nothing to do with those of my current employer, former Vice President Gore, who I'm working with again, or those of Vanderbilt University, for sure. So this is purely an exercise, right? It's, it doesn't come from the heart, necessarily. But the Democratic nominee is going to be Hillary Clinton.
But there's not a lot of oxygen.
And the Republican nominee is going to be John McCain. For two reasons. One is money. They both have the ability to stay the course and keep raising more money than everybody else. Senator Clinton already was the first to announce, I think, that she would not adhere to the spending limits for matching funds. So they're turning down matching funds. And they may turn down the public funds for the general election. Has that been decided?
I think they'll almost have to. Part of the reason why I suspect they will want to turn down funding is that in all likelihood, the general election campaign is going to start around March 1st of 2008, because one of the things that's gone on, we haven't really talked about this, is this rushing up front of all the states. In fact, Florida, how many people are from Florida? Quite a few. Well, Florida has just moved their primary to January 29th. And so it keeps moving. Other states will join. And New Hampshire, how many people are from New Hampshire? All right, from New Hampshire, excellent. I have a summer home in Vermont, so I love New England. And New Hampshire has a law on its books, in effect, that says our primary is simply held 2 weeks before anybody else's. That's basically the date. So that we could be having a primary on December 1st if things continue to rush to the front. But as a result, we're likely to know the nominees pretty early, conceivably even by early February. That somebody could, because there's a huge number of primaries being held on February 5th, somebody could roll through them and the nominee could be pretty much in place by then. So we're in for a long campaign, which means there's going to be a lot of money that's going to have to be raised, and it's going to be competitive, because remember, in 04 and 2000, the election was very, very close. This country is divided politically right now, and there's every reason to believe that even if, in fact, Obama wins or Fred Thompson wins or whoever, it's not going to be by 54-46. It's going to be by a narrow margin, which means they're going to have even more incentive to raise money. So the likelihood of it being a public funding working at all, let alone the nomination process, but even the general election, is probably not going to happen.
And this totally destroys the campaign finance law for presidential elections. You're going to have to go back in the drawing boards, because this will end it. Probably no candidate ever again will accept matching funds and adhere to spending limits. Because, not to go into this too deeply, but if you take matching funds and then if you accept the public money, about $80 million for the general election, that's all you can spend. You can't raise another dime, that's all you can spend at that point for the last 4 months in the campaign, or whatever it is. So this really changes the equation a lot. So I believe that the candidates who are going to be able to hang in there and raise the most money are those that will probably get to the finish line. So that's my guess. Now, others have the potential for doing this. Any of these four Republicans can raise that much money. The likely nominee here could certainly raise that much money. So it's not the deciding factor. But setting aside Giuliani, McCain is still the best known of the Republican candidates. He's been there before. He's run before. He's the only candidate other than Sidney Gore out of the equation, have actually run presidential campaigns before, and they know what it's about. So I still think McCain and Senator Clinton have the staying power to get to the finish line. I just don't feel comfortable in predicting which one of these folks, Senator Clinton or Senator McCain, could win. It's true that the public view is that the Republicans have messed it up and that any Democrat would likely win. And Senator Clinton is at least close to that majority now against the other Republican candidates. So it'll be a hard call. I would say that if President Bush cannot turn around his own standing, and the Iraq War continues to go south, and Senator McCain is so closely tied to the surge and the whole Bush administration approach to the war from the beginning, then you may end up with Senator Clinton as president. But there are a lot of ifs in there, and I would not say emphatically. And I do think all bets are off the former Vice President Gore gets in the race. It completely changes the complexion of the Democratic primary.
So those are the facts.
So
the exam
will take place in...
So we'll take some
How about questions? Some contrarian views? Right back here first.
Just in your handicap assessment of Senator McCain, to what extent, if at all, does age factor into your prediction?
It doesn't bother me. I think, in the sense that, look, I mean, Ronald Reagan broke all of the rules on age, for sure. President Clinton broke some other rules. He'll open up some... I'm being only partially facetious because, frankly, Giuliani, in particular, has been inoculated a little bit because of the national discussion during the Clinton administration, his particular issue. But so I don't really think it's that big a problem. It more is the projection of energy and vitality. I don't think it's so much a matter of age. I mean, it didn't hurt Ronald Reagan in 1980. Yeah.
Why is it that the Democrats seem to have such a pronounced death wish on the candidates? And I realize that this is more of an opinion perhaps than a question, but with Clinton and the high negatives, do not the negatives account for some kind of analysis here? You have not only a problem with the base, but you have the problem that would, first of all, have to be surmounted for her to get the nomination. Secondly, she has to win a national election, which to me would be absolutely And thirdly, you've got the matter of governance with a woman who would have such high negatives going in. And yet the Democratic Party does not seem to want to avoid this kamikaze mission that her candidacy ultimately practically would become.
Well, let me take it in reverse order, and then John can contradict me.
Can you repeat the question, please?
Yeah, the whole issue is basically, how can the Democrats nominate Senator Clinton? That it's a kind of death wish that continues. And the last part of it was, how could she even govern with such high unfavorables? I think that's irrelevant. The person that wins immediately has high approval ratings. Immediately. The 2000 election, the closest in history, so closely divided. You could argue that both sides felt strongly about their candidates. So George Bush had a 49.8% approval rating at the time. But within a day after Vice President Gore conceded the election in December, President-elect Bush's ratings went through the ceiling. So the American public has an extraordinary ability to forget about the pre-election attitudes. In terms of why would the Democrats nominate somebody who can't win, first of all, I don't think that there are Democrats that believe that she can't win a general election, but certainly her supporters believe that she can. And there are a lot of Republicans that believe that she can win the general election as well. So, and people don't generally vote that way. They vote for somebody they really like, they believe in, they think would make a difference. And clearly she's a unique kind of candidate. The same reason all those knuckleheads voted for Nader in 2000. It's the same mentality. Why would they vote for Ralph Nader? To throw away votes. So why would they nominate Senator Clinton? So I guess I take exception to that. And parties don't think like that. Parties are really a collection of millions of individuals. There are no party bosses anymore. Nobody makes these decisions in back rooms. These candidates on both sides, they have to go out and get votes. They have to raise money and ask for votes. So they develop constituencies and a base. So I think that while it may appear like that, and certainly those Senator Clinton's detractors have exactly that view, I don't think it quite works like that.
You know, let me just follow up a couple of things. First of all, remember that in 2004, President Bush had high negatives and still won, in the sense that there was a lot of people opposed to him. There are a lot of people who will never vote for Hillary Clinton. She's never going to get 54, 55% of the vote. The key is, you got to remember, it's Electoral College. If you think about all the states that Kerry won, she would be plausible that she holds all those states. And then does she take Ohio or Florida? And then she gets the Electoral College. So that, in point of fact, it's closer than you think. I mean, what's going to happen is that the problem that I think that Hillary Clinton poses for the country is that she is a polarizer, just like President Bush is. And so we would now flip from one side to the other side, even if, in fact, she isn't all that liberal. She's perceived as that way. And I think that's a bigger problem. And she would get support
but I think that the polarization this country has been undergoing would be continued. And maybe somebody, you know, like an Obama or Fred Thompson, or maybe even Romney and Giuliani, these are the types of people who'd be more likely to bridge that gap. And from the country's point of view, that may be a good thing. But remember, these elections have been very, very close. And so just a movement. And then you have the shift of more and more people are just identified with the Democratic Party as a reaction to Iraq. So her possibility of her being president, 2 years ago, I would have said no way. But I would not have anticipated the problems of the last 2 years. Yes, ma'am.
You just mentioned the word electoral college.
Yes.
What would it take to get rid of that?
It ain't happening.
The question is, what would it take to get rid of the Electoral College?
The problem with getting rid of the Electoral College, while I personally agree, and I think you probably agree too, I don't actually use those two terms around them very much. But in any case, the problem with the college is to reform it, to do away with it, you need three-quarters of the states to support a change. And I don't think that's likely because there's a lot of states like Wyoming. How many people are from Wyoming? See, nobody lives in that state. And it's just a haven for three electoral votes. That's my theory about Wyoming. With all, it's a beautiful state. But the point being that it's going to be very hard to get this kind of change. One of the tragedies, there were many problems following the 2000 election, but one of the biggest problems from a reform point of view is that everything was focused on the ballots and the chads and all those kinds of terms that you know of, but there was really no discussion about the Electoral College because everything focused on Florida, and that was a missed opportunity because maybe if you can get enough public awareness of it, that it would be something that you could change, but it's going to be very hard given it's hard to change the Constitution to begin with, but then you've got these states with a vested interest in maintaining it.
I have a scenario where the Electoral College could be abolished. It would take a scandal, and it would work sort of like this. There are several states that don't bind their electors. In other words, they're elected, and they can go to the Electoral College, and they could cast their votes for whomever they want. And so let's say in 2000, no, I would be a pipe dream. Let's say in some future election, it would be razor thin, but yet the electors of Nebraska or Maine, I think, or maybe one other, they decide this was a travesty. And they switch, and they throw the presidency to the candidate who did not win the enough electoral votes as voted. And that would happen. It would happen. And it would not be reversed. It would not be thrown into the House. It would be over. That would create a scandal, and I think that might force Congress to do something. And send it out to the states. It might still not happen, but it would take something extraordinary like that.
There is a move on part of some states to apportion the electoral vote.
Right.
Comment on that and what impact that might have. That bill was just introduced in North Carolina General Assembly to do just that.
Well, we also have one of the distinguished experts on this issue here asking the question, Congressman. The problem is in the national scheme is all the states would need to do that for it to become fair. For instance, the Republicans would love for California to do that, or New York to do that, and the Democrats would love, say, for Texas to do that. But that's the problem. I think it could happen, and in Colorado, they didn't come as close last time as they thought they would. But that could pick up steam, because more people understand the inequities of the Electoral College. That could very well happen. And if a few states, like North Carolina and others, were to do that, then the others said, well, we better do that too, because, North Carolina's gotten the jump on us, and you could see a steamroll, I think, if you did that.
There's another thing that's actually political science doesn't have a lot to contribute at times, but one of the things that political science have now found very clearly is that the people who are in the battleground states learn more about the candidates, become more informed, are basically better citizens by the end of the campaign, whereas people in, let's say, Alabama, which isn't a battleground state, they don't get the benefit of information that being bombarded. How many people are from Ohio? Do you remember the 2004 campaigns? You may well want to throw your TV out the window, the number of ads that were coming across your screens. But yet in Alabama, or here even in Tennessee, or a place like Texas, they weren't getting any. And so this is another problem with the college that is beginning to show, because the candidates are really focusing on these 18 or 19. Virginia's probably increased the size because of Webb's victory that that'll be a state in play. But it's very few, and there's just not much of incentive for candidates to spend time in Utah, for example. And that's a problem. There's lots of hands up. Yes, sir.
The model that you described is one that has a positive affiliation with either a Democrat or a Republican. And that doesn't ring true to me anymore. It seems like it's a model of negativism that pervades everything. That you have your base on the Republican side and your base on the Democratic side, but then there's this big group in the middle that seems to be more and more influenced by the negatives of whoever's candidate that it is, and aren't really affiliated in any strong sort of sense with whoever's out there. And it made me think more about that gentleman's question about the negatives. And when the other comment that was just made was about all this advertising, none of the advertising is positive. It's all negative. It's all negative advertising, and it's all with the purpose of tearing down the other candidate, making us think about those candidates in a different way, which leads me to the conclusion. Here's a question, Mark. Don't people that have less visibility now, like a Fred Thompson, perhaps, or Obama on the other side, perhaps, have a better chance of winning because nobody really knows that much about them, or knows less about them than a polarizing candidate like a Trump?
By the way, this is the nation's number one expert on negative advertising.
And actually, I think it's a good thing. So I'm glad that you've challenged on through Vanderbilt. And, I defend negative ads. And I think that you're right about the following observation. That is that you think there's all this negativity out there. The real source of the negativity is the news media. The news media cover it in dramatically more frequently than the candidates themselves air the ads. For example, the Swift Boat ad. All of you know the term Swift Boat because of 2004. The amount of ad buys from the Swift Boat for veterans was very small, but yet the news media covered it. And I think Kerry botched it. I think Kerry should have been prepared for it. I think it's totally legitimate to have that particular ad run. The Kerry people need to respond more effectively. They didn't, and that tells you something. One of the things about democracy to realize is that it is partly about criticism. And anytime you have any doubts about that, I urge people to go back and read the Declaration of Independence, because it was an attack document on another guy named George. And this is what democracy requires. Now, I think it's gone over the line in the sense that the attack ads themselves are totally legitimate. It's part and parcel of it. We need to know the good and the bad. Getting back to the comment about Hillary Clinton, you want to be reminded, and the public wants to be reminded about her downside. Because if you listen to Hillary Clinton, she's not going to tell you what's wrong with her. That has to fall to the other side. So there's really an important role, but the difficulty is that the news media spend too much time talking about it. And what they want to talk about isn't just attacks per se, but it's personal attacks. So if you attack, let's say you and I are campaigning against each other, and we have a legitimate difference on taxes. Well, the public should learn about that, correct? But if you and I actually then have some sort of little verbal jab, let's say, at each other in a debate, that's what gets covered, even though we have legitimate problems. So I think the negativity that you're referring to is genuine, it's a problem, but I lay the responsibility at the feet of the news media. And of course, when I tell journalists this, they, they don't buy that argument. But
of course, the bad side, though, is that you get such low voter turnout in elections because people get so turned off.
But actually, turnout 2004 popped up. It was way higher than previous elections. Why? Because I think the American public knew there were stakes. And whether you like Bush or dislike Bush, you turned out. And so turnout was pretty high. Our country's turnout is deflated because of the way we measure it. And it turns out that turnout has not been declining over the last 40 years. What we've been doing is mismeasuring it for the last 40 years. And so it's been flat, which is an amazing story. But again, the news media won't cover that because it's easy to talk about all the problems in this country. The realities are there's lots of good things that unfold, and the American public, I'll put my money on the American public any day as a collectivity over any set of politicians, because collectively they have pretty good judgment.
I thoroughly disagree with you on that issue. I realize it's not a debate among us here, but your assertion is so difficult to accept for this reason. The Swift Boat thing spoke for itself. It was so contemptible, it was so indefensible, it was so fraudulent. It was so wrong. Of course it was going to be covered. But relative to this gentleman's statement, what he's speaking about are the kinds of bombardment of negative ads that politically do influence elections.
Well, this is why politics is interesting. It turns out that, for instance, what proportion of negative ads do you think have been aired? The highest in presidential elections ever. What do you think the highest proportion is? You'd say 90, 80, 50 is the highest. 50% of the ads aired by presidential candidates are positive. I try to get journalists to cover positive ads. That's dull.
Are you counting the independent expenditures without
No, I'm talking about the candidate ads.
But see, that's not where the heavily negative ads come from. The Swiftfoot ad was a 527 ad.
But you do away with 527s, and what do you do away with? First Amendment rights.
Well, right, and we're not going to eliminate them. But they could have more transparency. Those guys that funded and produced the Swiftfoot ads should have been made accountable somehow. And frankly, I think that the Republican Party should have condemned them. The way, very honestly, current Senator Bob Corker condemned the ads that were running against Harold Ford and has introduced legislation to make those transparent. And maybe that would help a little bit.
And it's not going to be transparent.
Just take a right over here and explain right there.
Do you all have predictions on Al Gore's, the possibility of his running, and he gave us the other You give him high odds if he does run, so I'm curious about your impression.
Well, I was trying to be deferential to the field here. My own view is that if former Vice President Gore ran, that he would win the nomination, then he would win the general election in a landslide. But and I'm not biased, right? I couldn't put odds on it. I take it for face value. He said repeatedly he has no intention of running. I don't know where you stand on this, but he's had an extraordinary year. He's been able to elevate an issue that nobody seemed to care about other than scientists and has made it a popular appeal now. He's just done extraordinary things, and he has a wonderful life. He and Tipper live here in Nashville. And he's gotten a lot of affirmation for all of his work over the last year. I don't expect him to run. So I mean, what would the odds be? It would be almost impossible to do that. But if you want to see me outside afterwards.
Which of these candidates who probably can't get the nomination, like a Giuliani, might run as an independent and be the spoiler?
Good question. Did everybody hear that? What's the chance that someone like a Giuliani, if he didn't get the nomination, might run as an independent spoiler?
Well, actually, in the Roy and I teach a class called the American Presidency, and we finished it up just this term, and we have Pat Buchanan come into the class through a conference call. And Buchanan, who obviously has run as independent, he claimed that if Giuliani were to get the nomination, that the conservative base of the party would be so upset that then you'd see a third party potentially running. The difficulty is that if anybody, let's say on this side or on that side, runs, they guarantee their other side wins. And so let's say that Hillary Clinton is the nominee and Giuliani is going to be the Republican nominee. People have to decide whether they care enough about that to allow Hillary Clinton to be President Clinton.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
It's hard, it's hard for third parties to do well in this country, but it could change the outcome.
But the question also was, what's the chance that a Giuliani might run as an independent? I think it's highly unlikely. There's been some talk about Senator Brownback. I think he's disavowed that he would do that. Any Newt Gingrich, anything's possible. Anything's possible. I don't think any of the Democratic candidates would run as an independent. There's always the specter of Ralph Nader, but he is, thank God, his influence is dropping like a lead balloon. And he will. I don't think he will run.
Just quickly, is there any chance McCain would not take federal funding since it's his bill that's provided that?
It's very possible that he would.
That he wouldn't.
Yeah.
But the reason why McCain can disavow federal funding, given his position, is that the other side's going to do it.
Oh, I know that.
And so he has that as cover. I mean, because otherwise he can't compete as him. And I don't think anybody would try not to drive for that.
Chuck Hagel, Senator Hagel.
With Chuck Hagel, the name Chuck Hagel is right from Nebraska. Chuck Hagel is a very attractive figure in the Senate. A really smart guy, extremely able. He's done some extraordinary work. My sense has always been that his constituency is virtually identical to Senator McCain's. It was hard for me to see him mounting a campaign with both of them in the race. I can't imagine him running. He's a good Republican. I can't imagine him running as an independent. I think a social conservative, independent candidate would be someone like Pat Buchanan, but maybe not Pat. And if it happened and they caught on at all, if it were Giuliani, let's say, then the Republicans will lose the general election.
That's fair.
It's
seems to me that there's a lot of, on both sides, just negatives, people against each other. Do you think, is there anyone you see on either side of the field that would have a breakout positive identifiable group that people could identify with?
The question, and you can answer, I'll repeat, the question is can anybody break out as a positive candidate, a positive force?
And I think there was a comment earlier about somebody who's not necessarily well-known, and I think came earlier. I think that it's conceivable someone like Fred Thompson could, in the sense that even though he's socially conservative, he does appeal to independents and the old-style Reagan Democrats. Obama, of course, is the one that would immediately spring to mind, given the kind of rhetoric that he's pulling off. But at the end of the day, my big concern about Obama is that he's got an ability to speak, he's got an ability to connect with people. But this process is long enough that it's serious enough that he has to have a message. That is, he can't just talk about hope. He's got to get something behind that. And one reason why, for example, President Clinton became president after the 1992 election, winning that election, is he did have a plan and a message. People may not necessarily like it, per se, but the realities are he had a plan. And Obama hasn't yet found his footing on that. And I don't think that Hillary Clinton has either. Edwards has. Now, people may not like the message, but he's clearly found the message. And I think that's the big obstacle that faces Fred Thompson. And among these three, if you hold out Thompson, I think that Romney has a heck of a chance of being the nominee because he has things he wants to accomplish. Yes, he's flip-flopped on a lot of important issues. Running as a Republican in Massachusetts and winning is a hard thing, so you know that he had to do a few things that were more Democratic-like, if you will. But, you know, I think that there are a bunch of these people that can do it. And McCain is, interestingly, somebody who could have been a uniter, you know, 8 years ago, and I don't know whether he can regain his footing, but I think there are certain individuals. But at the end of the day, one of the things you have to realize is that politics is about disagreement. It's about who gets what, when, and where. And so inevitably there's going to be negatives associated with anybody. As Roy said earlier, as soon as Thompson runs, he's in the seduction phase, as he called it, then his negatives are really at a low. And as soon as he runs, they'll start raising. Because that's part of the process. You have to vet these people. And it's one reason why somebody like Hillary Clinton and McCain may well be the nominee, because they've been vetted and they've gone through this meat grinder. But if you want to sit behind the big desk, you have to be able to do it. I mean, people may have their qualms about President Bush, but he has gone through this meat grinder two times, come out the victor, and he's a very disciplined candidate, and he, you know, was able to show that he was qualified to do well, and qualified for the office because he did well. It's a grueling process that you really have to want it bad to go through it. But negatives are inevitably part of it, but I do think there's some uniters out there.
So back to the number there. Yeah.
A few minutes ago, you asked for contrarian views. So
excellent.
I'll for one. And after you finish laughing, you can try to answer it. What does the race look like if something unthinkable happens, such as Bush finds Al-Qaeda's nukes? If the country realizes that Saddam did have the nukes and Al-Qaeda's got them now, how does that change the landscape?
How has the campaign changed if President Bush's war initiative is vindicated?
Yes.
If somehow they find evidence that Saddam had nuclear weapons or other weapons of mass destruction, or they wipe out Al-Qaeda, they catch bin Laden, and they subject him to interrogation, and they find out some stuff that would somehow affirm President Bush. Do you have a view about this?
I mean, what I think if that happens, I don't think it necessarily changes people's attitudes dramatically. I mean, capturing Osama. Now you know why Freud is famous, okay? But capturing Osama would certainly raise Bush's ratings and would change the dynamics. But I think what it would do is it would probably actually hurt people like Obama and other candidates who don't have foreign policy experience. Because if, in fact, we find out a lot of more horrible things, let's say, the need to have somebody who's going to be that steady hand, somebody who's got the experience, somebody like a McCain all of a sudden, or even Giuliani, who might be unpalatable on the social front, for social issues, might all of a sudden become much more palatable. So I think it changes dynamics potentially dramatically. Not necessarily that, I still think the Democrats have a kind of a built-in edge for 08, but it would shuffle the deck a little bit with the odds. And I think Hillary Clinton would come out, because she, you know, she's been battle-tested, and I think that's something that will count in her favor.
It's an interesting question. I think the scenario is extremely unlikely, because I think the public has largely discounted anything now that happens on Iraq that would marginally be that kind of information. And I think it's pretty much known now that wasn't the case with Saddam. But I believe that unquestionably McCain is the big winner in the scenario that you played out. I think another question that's interesting, what if there's another terrorist incident between now and the general election, let's say? Obviously, that's a scary situation, but that could make all bets off all the way around.
To change things dramatically. We've been just told that we actually have to wrap up.
Really? This is too much time.
I don't know. There's some notes.
Lock the doors. We're staying.
How about one more question?
One more short question.
Okay.
They have a prayer. Thank you for showing up and have a great, great graduation.